poverty was imposed at such a level that there were massive riots. Chavez himself took part in an attempted military coup, spent a couple of years in jail. But the country, the growth rate collapsed. I mean, the country was in a disaster. As long as it was accessible to what Smedley Butler describes, then it was okay. In fact, supported it. That's all part of their memory. Just as the 2002 coup is part of their memory, just as the current measures of subversion are part of their memory.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on Latin America, stirrings in the servants' quarters. In his first full-length interview since Hugo Chavez's UN speech made his books bestsellers, Noam Chomsky talks about developments in Latin America and challenges to U.S. hegemony. Since the Monroe Doctrine, the United States has viewed Latin America as an area it could easily dominate and control. With the elections of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and Evo Morales in Bolivia, the region's traditional subordination to the Colossus in the north is changing. There are stirrings in the servants' quarters. Noam Chomsky, internationally renowned MIT professor, has long been a leading voice for peace and social justice. He's in huge demand as a speaker all over the world. The New Yorker says it is possible that, if the United States goes the way of 19th century Britain, Chomsky's interpretation will be the standard among historians 100 years from now. Author of scores of books, his latest are Failed States and the bestseller Imperial Ambitions. I talked with him in his office at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on September 29th, 2006. Welcome to the program.
Glad, as always, to be with you.
You quote Thucydides, "Large nations do what they wish, while small nations accept what they must." Why do you cite him?
Well, in my opinion, that's one of the two principles of international relations. Most of the theory you can more or less dispense with, but that's a principle which is operative in international affairs. And I think it should be paired with another principle brought up by Adam Smith, who is greatly revered but not very much read. He pointed out, he was talking about England, of course, he said that the principal architects of policy, state policy, who were the merchants and manufacturers, make sure that their own interests are very well attended to, however grievous the consequences for others, including the people of England. That's a second principle of international relations. And if you just think of these two simple principles, you can account for a fair amount of state policy, almost independently of which state it is.
There was a lot of comment and attention paid to Hugo Chavez's speech in New York at the UN in late September 06. He referred to Bush as a devil and comments about sulfur coming from the podium. Here in the United States, there's also, in some sectors, a tendency to attack Bush personally with a lot of name-calling. And do you think that's useful?
Well, first of all, I disagree with your first statement. I think there was no attention paid to Chavez's speeches, either at the General Assembly, the one that was at least mentioned, or the much more important one at the Security Council, where I couldn't find a single reference, didn't do a media search. And that was an important speech, had a lot of content. Also, the General Assembly speech had content, though it was more of a crowd pleaser than the Security Council speech, which was quite serious. The Security Council, he talked about, for example, reintroducing the concept of a new international economic order that was sponsored by the former colonial countries, the non-aligned movement in the 1970s, put forward by UNCTAD, the main UN development agency, a very serious program to try to bring the so-called third world into international affairs on a slightly more equal footing. That was shot down very fast, and instead the rich countries, primarily the United States, instituted almost the opposite, the so-called neoliberal order. But those are important issues for most of the world, not here. He brought up crucial questions about UN reform, suggested that the UN be placed in an international city. He suggested it should be in the South, where most of the world is. He brought up questions about energy consumption. Venezuela is an oil producer, but he was saying there's far too much oil used for energy production, which is very destructive of the environment, and socioeconomic orders have to be significantly modified, of course, particularly in the rich industrial countries, in order to reduce the catastrophic consequence of using oil for energy production, cars, heating, and so on. He talked about the Millennium Goals. He reiterated the importance of maintaining the UN Charter constraints on threat and use of force of in international affairs. Here he's re-endorsing the high-level UN summit, including U.S. leaders who affirmed it. And, I mean, that was a very serious speech. As far as I can see, not a word. Even in the General Assembly, where he was, it was referred to, the only references I saw were that he called Bush a devil, or, you know, said something about sulfur. Well, you know, it's not my rhetoric. I don't like the rhetoric. I don't like it when Rumsfeld calls him Hitler, or when Pelosi calls him a brutal thug, and so on and so forth. Yeah, that's rhetoric, but it's not very interesting. What's interesting is Rumsfeld's policies and Chavez's policies. That's if there were newspapers in the country, that's what they would be talking about, not what rhetoric people use. That's gossip. I don't like it, but who cares? I don't think it's constructive. I also don't think it's constructive to actually calling Bush names, to get back to your question. That's very constructive. That's programmed by Karl Rove. What he wants is to have liberal critics ridicule Bush because he says nuclear and misunderestimate and talks with a probably fake Texas accent and so on. In fact, my suspicion is he's probably trained to make grammatical errors so that then he didn't talk like that at Yale because then he'll be ridiculed by liberals and then you can come back with the big propaganda apparatus saying, see, those elite liberals who run the world and are sitting drinking French wine and eating quiche don't understand us ordinary guys, you know, the regular guys like the guy working on the assembly line and George Bush who's going back to his ranch to cut brush and so on and so forth. I mean, that's all part of the imagery. So if you want to contribute to that imagery and to the success of the ultra-right, then yes, you should make fun of George Bush's accent and the other forms of ridicule. But mostly it's either destructive or childish, and the same holds of everyone else's rhetoric. What's important is the content, and that was systematically evaded. Actually, I had the resources. I'd like to do a media search and see if there was any reference to the substance of his remarks. After all, even at the General Assembly, you read the New York Times review, it was a news account, what's called a news account. It was mostly kind of gossip and making fun of it and so on. However, they did have a phrase which was interesting. They said he received prolonged applause so long that the chair had to intervene to stop it. Well, you know, any journalist would ask, or commentator would ask the next question. Why? Why did he receive prolonged applause? Is it because he called George Bush a devil? No. It's because he was expressing a point of view which happens to be very widely accepted in the world. In fact, it's the overwhelmingly dominant position. Chavez's views are called controversial. It's quite the opposite. It's the views of the U.S. media and commentators that are controversial. It's not controversial when Chavez says the U.S. is one of the greatest threats to peace in the world. That's not even controversial in Europe. When European, you take a look at polls in Europe, when people are asked to list the major threats to peace, the United States is way in the lead, far above Iran or anybody else. So if Chavez says it at the UN, what's controversial? What's controversial is the U.S. position of saying that it's controversial, because it's not. I mean, unless you define the world as the New York Times editorial board, it's not controversial. Well, those are the kind of reports that should have been carried out. Or if you want to talk about Venezuela, talk, you know, every reference that I see calls Chavez, tin pot dictator, so on and so forth. And by what standards is he a dictator? I mean, he's been repeatedly elected in elections certified as free and fair. He allowed the media in Venezuela bitterly condemn him in terms which are unimaginable virtually in the United States. There was a military coup that briefly overthrew him. It was supported by the top media. They haven't been punished for it. Supported, of course, by the Bush administration. They've had a series of referendums, all of which he's won handily, without any coercion that anyone knows about, or certainly not by international standards. Nothing like the gentleman who's being welcomed at the White House today from Kazakhstan, which is really a dictator and a brutal one, but that's fine. He gets the red carpet treatment. A few remarks about maybe he's not perfect or democracy has to come slowly and so on and so forth. But the most important question is, what do Venezuelans think about him? I mean, after all, that's the question you ask about a political leader. Well, we know. In the years that he's been in office, support for the elected government has steadily risen. It is now the highest in Latin America. That's of some interest. The next question is to ask what the reasons are. I mean, is it because he calls Bush a devil? No, it's because there are social programs that are helping the great majority of the population. This should be a very rich country, Venezuela, plenty of resources. It has a small, very small, super rich, elite, highly privileged sectors, and a huge mass of extremely impoverished people who apparently believe, you can argue about whether they're right or not, but they seem to believe that this is the first government that's ever cared for them. Is that undemocratic? In fact, what's called undemocratic here is extremely interesting. So, for example, when Morales in Bolivia made moves towards nationalization of Libya's resources, he was condemned as authoritarian, dictatorial, attacking democracy. Did it matter that he was supported by about 95% of the population? Is that what dictatorial means? We have a particular concept of democratic, which means do what we say, then you're democratic. You do what the population wants, you're not democratic. In fact, that shows dramatically. It's shocking that people can't see it. Every journal commentary, every scholarly article talks about Bush's commitment to bring democracy and freedom to the world. I was just listening to BBC this morning driving in. They're talking about, well, you know, some of his actions don't seem to conform to his commitment to bring democracy to the world. What's the evidence for the commitment? I mean, the evidence is the dear leader pronounced it. And since we must be voluntary North Koreans, that makes it his commitment. Dear leader says it, it's true. You don't even assert it. You just presuppose it because of our extraordinary conformism to power. What's this got to do with democracy?
It's the Cisneros group that dominates most of the media in Venezuela, and there's a brilliant documentary about that April 2002 coup in Venezuela made by two independent filmmakers from Galway, Ireland, called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Thomas Friedman, writing in the New York Times on September 21st, I mean, we're talking about name-calling, he's calling Chavez a buffoon, and a petro-authoritarian, this is a term that he's coined, And he says, Chavez uses Venezuela's oil riches to try to sway democratic elections in Latin America and promote an economic populism that will eventually lead his country into a ditch.
He can scream as much as he likes. It's undoubtedly true that he's trying to influence elections. Is that something new? We don't try to influence elections. Not only do we work desperate, the U.S. government, that is, to influence them, but if they come out the wrong way, we punish the population. Is Chavez doing that? So sure, if you don't think countries should influence elections, then shut down the National Endowment for Democracy, then shut down the State Department, which is right now, for example, intervening massively in the Nicaraguan election. It's telling the people of Nicaragua, the ambassador from Condoleezza Rice's orders, I presume, is telling them, if you don't vote the way we say, we're going to strangle you. Is that influencing elections? I mean, has Chavez ever, could he do that if he wanted to? Has he ever tried? As to whether the policies will lead into a ditch, Thomas Friedman is hardly an authority. The policies that he's been supporting have been a disaster for most of the South. I mean, if you look, take a look at the last 25 years, the policies he loves, growth rates have sharply declined. There are countries that have done very well, like the East Asian countries, China, say, South Korea, Taiwan, but they've done very well by violating the rules that he's calling for. They radically violated the IMF World Bank rules, the Washington Consensus, which he praises, and they grew. On the other hand, the countries that observed his rules rigorously had the worst, extremely sharp decline in economic growth and just about every other macroeconomic measure. Latin America had the most rigorous adherence to the rules that he recommends. Were the worst disasters, Latin America and Southern Africa. The way these figures are muddled in the pronouncements by the World Bank, by many economists and others, because they, for example, argue that growth has really improved greatly, that poverty is reduced, and so on. The way they get this result by the neoliberal rules, the way they get these results is by mixing together two quite different things. One is export orientation, and the other is following the Washington Consensus neoliberal rules. Now, those are two different things. So China is a billion people, which has been dedicated to export promotion, but violating the neoliberal rules. So therefore, if you muddle all of this together, you can say, well, the neoliberal rules work because a billion Chinese had a high growth rate, forgetting what's happening inside China, had a high growth rate by violating the rules. That proves that the rules work. I mean, this kind of deception is going on all the time. If you disaggregate and you look at what's really happening, the programs have been a very serious failure, as they have been elsewhere. I mean, the most rigorous application of these rules, the rigorous application of these rules typically requires dictatorship because people don't like them. And the most rigorous application was in Chile after the Pinochet coup in 1973. That's when the Chicago Economist came down. They could do anything they wanted. The country was under the rule of a vicious police state, so nobody could object. And they imposed all the orthodox rules. Well, you know, within a few years, by 1982, Chile suffered the worst economic collapse of its history. The government had to step in and bail out virtually the whole of private industry, the banks, and so on. In fact, one famous international economist called it the Chicago Road to Socialism. The government state owned more of the economy than it had under Allende. That was the great neoliberal experiment. Finally, the military couldn't handle the situation anymore. They turned it back to civilians, and Chile slowly recovered with a kind of a mixed economy of a complex sort, and it's called a free market miracle. But in fact, the economy relies very heavily on a nationalized copper industry, Codelco, nationalized by Allende. They didn't dare privatize it. Very efficient, apparently, and I think it's the biggest copper producer in the world. So copper prices go up, Chile does fine, you know. And in other ways, the economy is somewhat recovered from the orthodox prescriptions which devastated it. The same in neighboring Argentina. Argentina was, you know, rigorously followed IMF rules. That means Treasury Department rules, the ones that Thomas Friedman writes about, led to a total catastrophe. Finally, Kirchner was elected. He radically violated IMF rules. There was a very significant recovery. They are now, as he puts it, ridding themselves of the IMF, meaning the Treasury Department and Thomas Friedman. They're ridding themselves of the IMF, thanks to, in part, to the fact that Venezuela helped them buy up the debt. Probably do the same in Bolivia. Well, okay, they've undergone a pretty remarkable economic recovery with very interesting moves like worker-owned cooperatives and so on. Well, you know, that's the real world. I mean, it's different if you're eating in elegant restaurants and meeting your rich friends and reading the editorials in the Wall Street Journal.
Avi Lewis and Naomi Klein have documented some of those outcomes in Argentina in a film they made called The Take. Orwell wrote decades ago in his essay, Politics and the English Language, the word fascism has no meaning except insofar as it signifies something not desirable. The term is being used a lot today. The Bush administration talks about the enemy being Islamofascism. But even among people who might describe themselves as left or liberal, they use the term to describe increasing government surveillance, snooping and spying, and they point to extraordinary rendition and secret prisons and extrajudicial assassinations and the trashing of the Geneva Conventions. Are you're uncomfortable with the term?
Fascism? Fascism has lost its meaning years ago. In fact, if we want to be serious about it, we should recognize that in the 1930s, when fascism was really alive, it was regarded pretty favorably. And so, for example, Roosevelt described Mussolini as that admirable Italian gentleman. Fortune magazine had an issue in which, from memory, I may have it a little wrong, the cover was something like, the WOPs are unwopping themselves, meaning these racist terminology is considered quite normal in those days. So, I mean, finally, Italy's working. Hitler was supported. Nowadays, appeasement is thought of as a bad word. It wasn't at the time. Thought of as pretty progressive. So, for example, Roosevelt's main advisor, Sumner Wells, came back from the Munich agreement, Munich granting Hitler conference, giving Hitler controlled Czechoslovakia, you know, 1938 after all, very effusive about how we're entering a new period of peace and justice with our Hitler's going to, you know, help bring stability and justice to the world. I mean, this went right up to the war. And of course, American business loved it.
Let's get back to our little region over here, as Henry Stimson, FDR's Secretary of War, described Latin America. There's an interesting man, General Smedley Butler, the only soldier in the history of the United States to win the Congressional Medal of Honor twice. He wrote a little book called War is a Racket that is now circulating by a tiny press in L.A. called Feral, F-E-R-A-L, I think is how it's spelled. Butler said in a remarkable admission that he was a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. And then he lists the achievements, his achievements. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys. I helped in the raping of a half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. The record of racketeering is long. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests. In China, just jumping continents, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. Then he concludes with, you know, looking back on it, he says, I feel that I could have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was operate his racket in three wards in Chicago. And I operated, he says, on three continents. It would seem in a people's history of the United States, certainly in Latin American relations, that Smedley Butler would have a very prominent place, but he's basically unknown.
It's also played an important part in domestic U.S. politics. He helped abort a possible military coup with business backing to overthrow Roosevelt in the early 30s. He was supposed to be part of it, but he spilled the beans and helped break it up. So, yeah, he's a very important figure in American history because he was honest. And he did all those horrible things, and they are horrible, and the consequences remain. I mean, one of the main reasons why Haiti is such a disaster area, one of the most miserable countries in the world, is because of what's called Wilsonian idealism in American history and political science. Now, Wilson sent his Marines, headed by Smedley Butler, to Haiti and the Dominican Republic. In Haiti, they disbanded the parliament at gunpoint, as he put it, by genuine marine methods, at gunpoint, kicked out the parliament because the parliament was refusing to accept what was called a progressive legislation, for which Franklin Roosevelt later took credit, probably falsely. The legislation would have allowed Haiti to be bought up, Haitian lands to be bought up by American corporations. And the parliament refused to accept it. So therefore, Wilson's Marines went in there, kicked out the parliament, ran a referendum in which I think maybe 1% of the 5% of the population voted or something like that, and they won something like 99% of the vote, so therefore they had the progressive legislation. They went ahead and turned Haiti into a corporate farm, meanwhile killing probably maybe 10, 15,000 people, restoring virtual slavery, smashing the society. It was already been devastated by French imperialism. Then the Americans, they sort of gave it the final blow, did leave it finally in the hands of a brutal National Guard, which had been running it ever since, and which George W. Bush and Jacques Chirac essentially restored in 2004, overthrowing the democratically elected government. All of this is called democracy promotion and progressive actions. It was, in the Dominican Republic, it was pretty much the same, except not quite as harsh, because the Dominican Republic was just, in the terminology of the time, spics, but Haiti was niggers. So you had to be harsher on them. And you look back at even the rhetorical framework of the Wilsonian idealists, let alone what they did. I mean, it's shocking. Butler played a leading role in it, as he says, elsewhere too, but he spilled the beans. So he's out of history. In fact, I think there was an effort to take his Medal of Honor away, if I recall correctly.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky on Latin America, Stirrings in the Servants' Quarters. This is AR. You can order copies of this program and the book Imperial Ambitions by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering. Going back to Venezuela, you've reviewed some of the history between the United States and Venezuela, and you talk about Juan Vicente Gomez and Perez Jimenez. Again, not household names, but perhaps might be in the memory of someone like Hugo Chavez and others in Venezuela. Talk about who they were.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's a kind of another. Maybe I can add a third rule of international affairs to Thucydides and Adam Smith. That is, the people who hold the clubs insist upon historical amnesia. For us, history's kind of old, antiquated, boring stuff. Who cares about that? Let's march on to a glorious future. But the people who are hit by the clubs, they tend to remember history because they know that it matters, and they see it being reenacted. And Venezuela's a case in point. Venezuela was pretty much a British protectorate. When the oil age began around the end of the First World War, Woodrow Wilson, in another act of Wilsonian idealism, kicked the British out of Venezuela, took it over, supported the vicious dictatorship, the Gomez dictatorship, but Venezuelan oil was now under U.S. control, so everything was fine. That continued right through Perez Jimenez. I think he got a Medal of Honor from the Eisenhower administration, again, a brutal dictator. But Venezuelan oil was available, controlled pretty much by U.S. corporations, and not just oil. They have other natural resources. American corporations go in there, do what they want. There was a small elite which was enriching itself and was collaborating them. They pretty much ran the government, so everything was perfect. There was a little deviation, support for Betancourt and a couple of other sort of social democrats, but that's pretty much the story. Under the last pre-Chavez government, it was a neoliberal disaster. I mean, poverty was imposed at such a level that there were massive riots. Chavez himself took part in an attempted military coup, spent a couple of years in jail. But the growth rate collapsed. I mean, the country was in a disaster. As long as it was accessible to what Smedley Butler describes, then it was okay. In fact, supported it. That's all part of their memory. Just as the 2002 coup is part of their memory. Just as the current measures of subversion are part of their memory. I mean, let's just imagine that, say, Iran had supported a military coup in the United States that overthrew the government and was finally overturned by popular reaction. Suppose that Iran was sponsoring that coup. And then Iran came into the United States to support democracy by spending, you know, a lot of money for what they would call pro-democracy organizations, namely those opposed to the government and so on. How would we like it? You know, well, I don't have to talk about it. But when we do it, it's support for democracy.
Returning to Hugo Chavez and Venezuela, a couple of initiatives. One is Venezuela, along with Argentina, Cuba, and Uruguay, have started Telesur, which is a TV channel that Latin America-wide TV channel that seeks to present news more from a grassroots perspective. If you could talk about that, it's been described as kind of the Al Jazeera of Spanish. And the other initiative that he's undertaken, which again is called, quote, controversial in the United States, is supplying home heating oil at discount prices to low-income communities in Boston, not very far from where we're sitting, the South Bronx, and other poor areas of the United States.
Let's start with the last one. That's an interesting one. What actually happened is that a group of senators approached the major oil companies and asked politely if they could provide cheaper oil to help poor families over last winter, where prices were really high and they couldn't afford heating. They got one response from Citgo, a Venezuelan-run company. And yes, the Venezuelan-run company agreed to the request of the senators to provide oil at cheap rates to poor people around the United States. Well, I was bitterly condemned by the government, by the media, and so on, as Chavez just using his oil wealth to gain support and so on, as if our foreign aid, like, it's totally altruistic. We never do it for any political or other purpose and so on. But he was doing it. And I doubt that the people in South Boston understood the subtleties. So, sure. But he's also doing it in the Caribbean and in South America. I mean, the Caribbean countries receive oil at a Petrocaribe program at basically discount prices, I mean, cheap credit and so on. Yeah, that's buying influence, undoubtedly. You could say the same about Operation Miracle. There's Cuba and Venezuela are doing exactly what we're all taught in graduate school of economics that we're supposed to do. They're pursuing their comparative advantage. Comparative advantage of Venezuela is oil. Comparative advantage of Cuba is highly trained, highly skilled professionals, doctors, teachers, nurses, and so on. So they're basically exchanging them in Venezuela itself and Cuba, but also elsewhere. Operation Miracle in the Caribbean is a project where, with Venezuelan financial support, Cuban doctors are going to places like Jamaica, and right now they're concentrating on blindness, finding people who are blind and who could be have the sight restored by advanced surgical treatments, and they're taking them to Cuba, treating them. They come back to Jamaica, and they can see. You think that has an effect on Jamaicans? Yeah, you bet it does. Well, this is just another example of Venezuelan imperialism, as if we couldn't do it, for example. In fact, there are, everything that happens here is in secret, so you can't be sure, but there are apparently the U.S. and Mexico tried to develop a program to counter this, but it didn't get off the ground. But we don't have the resources to carry out Operation Miracle. If we were to do it, it would be called magnificent humanitarianism. When Cuba and Venezuela does it, it's do it as well as more of these tin pot dictators trying to run the world, you know, and destroy us. But it matters to the people who receive the aid, just as buying up the large part of the Argentine debt to rid them of the IMF means something to people in Argentina. The pipeline that Venezuela has proposed from Venezuela down to Bolivia, if it is implemented, would be of great benefit to the countries of Latin America, method of unification of them, moving towards some sort of energy integration and independence. U.S. hates the idea, of course, but you know, it sounds like a reasonable idea. And on and on. About Telesur, there's a very interesting background there, which, of course, we suppressed here, but it's important. I mentioned before that Chavez at the Security Council had talked about reviving the new international economic order that was sponsored by the major countries, most of the world, the non-aligned countries in the 1970s and by UNCTAD. There was also another one, New International Information Order, was sponsored by UNESCO in this case. The idea of it was to try to give third world countries some sort of input into the international media system, instead of having it totally monopolized by a few rich Western powers, U.S. primarily. So they wanted to say, well, we should have some entry into this. That was bitterly attacked in the United States across the spectrum. It was attacked as an effort to end the free press, control journalists, you know, forcing journalists to register. You know, huge attack right across the spectrum, full of lies, most outrageous lies. The press, like the New York Times, would not permit responses by UNESCO officials. And it built up so much opposition that the U.S. defunded UNESCO to try to prevent a third world input into the international information system. They understand free press means we have a monopoly. You've got to shut up and listen to what we say. That's a free press. There's a very good book about this by William Preston, Edward Herman, and Herbert Schiller called Hope and Folly, published by University of Minnesota Press, which exposes the whole story. And it's an incredible story. I've never seen a review. I've never seen a comment. I suspect you can't even find it in the libraries, because it's just telling the wrong story. It's talking about the extreme opposition to freedom of the press by U.S. media, intellectuals, and government. And it's a very interesting story. Telesur is attempting to revive it. Same is true of Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is hated by the U.S.-backed tyrants who run the oil states, Saudi Arabia and the rest of them. They despise it. And by the United States for the same reason. It's an independent voice. You can't have that. The U.S. bombed its facilities in Kabul and Baghdad. They claim it was an accident. I don't think anybody with their eyes open believes that. When the U.S. was finally compelled by popular resistance to allow an election in Iraq, they tried to prevent it in every possible way. Of course, now taking credit for it. But when they tried to prevent it, they couldn't prevent it anymore, so they tried to subvert it. One of the ways was by driving Al Jazeera out of Baghdad. I mean, you can't have a free election if we don't control everything, obviously. So they were kicked out of Iraq. The administration has sought in every way to stop them. One of the most comical press conferences that ever took place, I think, barely reported, so, you know, I only have hints about it, was when the emir of Qatar came to Washington. And he was called on the carpet by Colin Powell and everyone else who tried to get him to shut down Al Jazeera. He had a press conference in which, tongue-in-cheek, he informed the press that in Qatar they believe in this thing called freedom of the press. And, of course, it sometimes means that things happen. People say things we don't like, but you got to understand that not every country has the same principles and so on. Well, I didn't see much reporting about that. The Emir of Qatar finally, under U.S. pressure, agreed to privatize the station. Bush administration said that won't work. Colin Powell and the rest said, no, you can't do that. You got to close it down. There cannot be either a public or a private station that is independent of our control. That's our concept of democracy promotion. They nevertheless kept it. Al Jazeera is very widely watched over the Arab world. When during this U.S.-Israeli invasion in Lebanon that practically destroyed the country, you got little bits and pieces of it in the West, but Al Jazeera was reporting what was happening. I mean, their correspondents are right on the ground. They show the pictures. You know, people watch them, and it has an effect. Now they're trying to open up an English television alternative. Of course, that would mean through cable. Last I heard, they have barely been able to get an entry. I think maybe one cable station somewhere is willing to pick them up. But there's going to be tremendous resistance to this. You cannot allow alternatives. And Telesur is an example. The U.S. doesn't have the power to close it down. And, Chavez isn't going to listen to Powell and Rice when they tell him to shut it down. It is an alternative. It's a voice that expresses the position of the vast majority of the world's population, at least to some extent, whereas we insist on an information system which is under the control of the rich and powerful and works for their interests.
Jahan Nujem has actually done a documentary on Al Jazeera called Control Room. Again, one of these, there's been an extraordinary burst of new films and on DVDs about various public issues, and this is just another one. I want you to talk about the significance of Venezuela joining Mercosur and the general integration that's going on inside the continent, but then also South-South integration. In an article in International Socialist Review, you said Venezuela has forged probably the closest relations with China of any Latin American country. Why is that significant?
All of that is very significant. I mean, what's happening in Latin America is very important. It's faltering steps, and many setbacks, but the steps are being taken. This is the first time since the Spanish conquest that Latin America has begun moves towards independence and integration. Now, I have to qualify that. They have tried it before, but have been smashed by force. So, for example, Brazil had a moderately populist democratic government in the early 60s. Kennedy administration organized a military coup. took place after the assassination, but was basically organized already, which imposed a neo-Nazi-style national security state. It was the first plague that then spread throughout the continent of Chile, Argentina, Central America, which just turned into a massacre and so on. But it was started in the Kennedy administration. So they have tried in the past, as they tried during the, you know, they freed themselves from Spain. And there were many efforts. But this is the first one that has a chance of succeeding, because by now they have extricated themselves to an extent from Western control, first European, then U.S. So they've extricated themselves. Venezuela's playing a big role in it, but not the only one. By now there's a wave of democratic elections with popular participation and a kind of a leftish orientation throughout the continent from Venezuela to Argentina. In fact, the countries that the United States, there's a new doctrine around, very popular, you read it in foreign affairs and so on, that there are good leftists and bad leftists. So the bad ones are Chavez and so on. The good ones are Lula and couple of the Bachelet in Chile and so on. I mean, what the government and the media and intellectuals are now calling the good leftists are countries that the U.S. would have been trying to overthrow not many years ago. But as the hemisphere, most of it, the southern hemisphere, part of this hemisphere, drifts towards independence and integration, the U.S. had to shift its positions. I mean, the major means of control have lost their power. There are two major means of control. International affairs is not a complicated story. One means of control has just been violence, mailed fist, and the other has been economic controls. Recent period, IMF, Treasury Department, so on, World Bank. Well, they're both losing their efficacy. The last effort of the U.S. to use violence, the traditional means, was in Venezuela in 2002. The U.S. had to back down. Now pretends it didn't have anything to do with it, packed down because, for one thing, popular reaction in Venezuela, but also because of the reaction in Latin America. It was a very strong negative reaction. I think Chile was maybe the only country that supported the coup, at least that I can recall. Maybe Colombia, but probably Colombia. But there was a very strong reaction. I mean, Latin America, they just take democracy more seriously than in the West, certainly the United States. They don't like military dictatorships being instituted to overthrow democratic governments. So the use of violence is declining. I wouldn't say it's gone. In fact, the U.S. probably has more military forces in Latin America now than at the height of the Cold War. Training of Latin American officers has shot up, School of the America-style training. In fact, for the first time, military spending, U.S. military, what's called aid to Latin America, I think is higher than the total amount of economic aid from key federal agencies. That's never happened in the Cold War. And bases are going up all over the place, and there's preparations being made for military action of one sort or another. But it doesn't have the capacity that it had in the past. You can't just instigate military dictatorships and then support them. So that's lessened. Support of the economic strangulation has lessened. Kicking out the IMF is one example. Bringing up China. Meanwhile, integration's going on. Slow, like Mercosur, which is trade area of the South, Southern Cone, Southern countries, but Venezuela joined it. Venezuela's joining it was hailed by President Kirchner of Argentina and Lula da Silva in Brazil as a great step forward. How meaningful it will be, well, you have to see. There's a lot of internal problems and so on. But it's the beginnings of integration. You look at the history of Latin America, very disintegrated. I mean, the Latin American countries, we're talking about the Latin American elites, tiny elites, and very rich elites with huge poverty, but that's what we call the countries. They ran the countries. They were oriented toward the West. Even the transportation systems were oriented toward the West. Capital flow was to the West, not for investment. The chateaus were in the Riviera, you know, so you take your vacations. Not with each other. Your children went to Western universities. You know. But the integration among the countries is very slight, in fact, a lot of conflict. Well, it's beginning to be overcome. There are steps towards integration. Mercosur is an example. The Venezuelan participation is an example. What about China? Well, China terrifies Washington planners. It's called in the national intelligence estimates the main threat to the long-term threat to the United States. I mean, why? Is it going to attack us? No. It's not a military threat. In fact, of all the major powers, it's put in the least effort in military spending. Practically no deterrent force, even. Small deterrent force. I mean, it's building up in response to Bush militarism, but very slight. It's a threat because it can't be intimidated. It does what it wants. Moving into Latin America, into Saudi Arabia, into Iran, everywhere, driving the U.S. crazy. In Latin America, they are becoming a leading trading partner, not just for Venezuela, though I think Venezuela is in the lead. The raw materials exporters, like Chile and Brazil, are increasing their trade with China. They export raw materials. China invests and so on. In Venezuela, they're trying to diversify their oil exports so they're not so dependent on a very hostile United States. It's natural and sensible. A lot of it's being diversified to Latin America, but also to China. And the United States government is naturally very unhappy about that. We're supposed to control resources and markets. Nobody else is.
In some of your talks, usually toward the end, you use the metaphor of looking in the mirror. Talk about that.
Well, that's back to historical amnesia. We should ask who we are and what we do. I mean, for example, when Chavez gets prolonged applause at the General Assembly, instead of ridiculing the rhetoric, we ought to be asking why. You know, what is leading to the fact that public opinion polls, even in Europe, let alone the rest of the world, regard the United States as a major threat to world peace and even to their own existence? What is that coming from? It's not enough to say they hate us because of our freedom. No, they don't. In fact, take a look at yourself, see what you're doing. What have we done to Iran for the last 50 years? What are we doing to Iraq right now? Why is it that in the polls that appeared just a few days ago, which I have yet to see reported, it turns out that 70% of Iraqis want U.S. troops out within a year, and most of the rest want them out not long after. And in Baghdad, about two-thirds want them out immediately. Why is that? Well, you know, you look at the studies, they'll tell you. It's because there's an overwhelming majority that thinks that the U.S. is contributing to the violence and sectarianism. And an overwhelming majority thinks the U.S. is building permanent military bases, which they don't want. Well, are we? Yeah, you take a look at the expenditures that are reported. Yeah, they're building what they call semi-permanent bases, which means permanent as long as we want them there. And they're being built in a manner that entails permanence, you know, deep underground bunkers. In fact, the U.S. isn't even providing the Iraqi army with the means of support for an army, apparently on the assumption that the U.S. forces are going to be there to provide the logistics and support and the backup and the bases and move in when they have to and so on. Well, Iraqis don't want that, not only because they think, probably rightly, that we're helping instigate the violence, but because they don't like to be occupied by a foreign power. Would we want to have Iranian bases being built here? You know, okay, so let's look ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves why people in the world have this impression of U.S. government policies. And strikingly, much of the U.S. population has the same impressions, but is excluded effectively from the political system and even the media, which don't report their attitudes. So let's look at ourselves, see what kind of country we have. Is that what we want to be? Do we want to be a country that's looked at this way and suffer the consequences? Because we will. Well, you want to look yourself in the mirror, maybe learn something about yourself. That should be priority number one. Ever since Socrates, know thyself, then maybe you can talk about other people. But yes, sure, we should try to understand ourselves, not just shout jingoistic slogans and because our dear leader announces that Chavez is a brutal dictator, we have to scream he's a brutal dictator. Well, maybe so, but draw your own conclusions, not just because the dear leader pronounced it. We don't have to be voluntary North Koreans.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Noam Chomsky on Latin America, Stirrings in the Servants' Quarters. I talked with him in his office at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on September 29th, 2006. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. AR, celebrating 20 years, is independent,